And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, Congress is off this week. They have worked hard, actually, particularly for January. And February, you don't see a lot of hard work normally in January and February. But this Congress has hit the ground running, and President Obama, who has been president really a scant 3.5 weeks, not that long when you think about it, has achieved a number of big things. The most famous among them, of course, his stimulus package, which we'll talk about a little bit today and a lot more over the next couple of days. I have two congressmen coming on the Inside Scoop in the next couple of days to talk about the stimulus package, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I want to talk about what it achieved, what it has yet to achieve, was it big enough, and how the Republicans, have not joined in to help the plan. Now, we're going to have Congressman Chris Van Hollen on tomorrow and Congressman Frank Pallone, the chairman of the Energy Subcommittee, the Health Subcommittee of the Energy Committee. He's coming on Thursday. But I want to, I guess, talk around the stimulus package a little bit today. We can talk a little bit about it. But in general, I want to focus on bipartisanship. Obama ran for president on what many of us worried was contradictory promises, in the sense that he promised to do a number of things that are your standard liberal democratic fare, bring us closer to universal health care, help the environment, green jobs, to rebuild our nation's roads and bridges, to promote education, to get us off of foreign oil, to stop global warming, stem cell research, really the whole sort of gamut of ideas that most of us liberals support and support dearly. At the same time, he ran saying that he would be a different kind of politician, that he would reach out across the aisle, that he would listen to the best ideas of the opposing party and make a very bipartisan administration to go beyond the failed battles of the past, he said when he was fighting Hillary Clinton, implying that, you know, all the partisanship of the Clinton years would melt away. And at the time, I have to admit, I was a bit skeptical. I said on the air that even though I endorsed Barack Obama, I found his two goals contradictory. One goal, the goal of promoting a standard liberal democratic agenda, not a leftist agenda, not a far-left agenda, but a standard center-left, middle-of-the-road Democratic Party agenda. And at the same time, reaching out to the Republicans who have deserted not just the liberals, but the center as well, and moved so far to the right. I remember asking quite clearly whether Obama's reach out to Republicans would cause him to sacrifice his ideals. And I think that's still an open question. It's something that really we don't know the answer to, and that's okay. He's only been president 3.5 weeks. I think it may take a year or more to really determine where Obama's going to stand on the question of what happens when the rubber meets the road. What happens when standard liberal democratic ideas meet Republican opposition? I'm sure most of you recall in the Bill Clinton years, he practiced something called triangulation, trying to stand in between the liberal Democrats in Congress and the Republicans on the right and putting him in the center, which did help him politically, no question about it. And he did achieve some things that I think wouldn't be characterized normally on a left-right divide, things like putting more cops on the streets or welfare reform that, again, I think people in the center and the center-left supported, but many on the left bitterly opposed and said was unfair. And certainly many on the right felt did not go far enough. Well, Obama, no question about it, has reached out to bipartisanship in tone. This is a man who believes in negotiating with our enemies, with talking with Iran, with Russia, sitting down at the table with people who, let's face it, are some of America's bitterest enemies. You think if he could talk to Iran, he could talk to Republicans who, for all their imperfections and wrongness, are at least not trying to bomb American cities. Well, he tried. He tried hard. He went not one, not twice, but three times to the Republican House caucus and sat with Republican members of the House and tried to persuade him to vote for his stimulus package. Now, it should be noted that George Bush went not once to the House Democratic caucus during his presidency when the Democrats were in the minority, and even in the last 2 years when the Democrats were in the majority, George Bush simply did not reach out to Democrats. But you may recall that his campaign rhetoric was entirely the opposite. George Bush famously ran in 2000 to be a uniter, not a divider. Remember that? God, that seems like an eon ago. He talked about the fact that he could reach across the aisle, and he didn't even try. Bill Clinton famously did reach across the aisle. For example, I mentioned welfare reform and did get a few Republicans on board, but not with his economic policies. I think all too few Americans recall that in 1993, when Clinton passed a much, much more modest package than the Obama stimulus package, he also failed to get a single Republican vote. Not only did the House vote on a party line basis and he won by one vote in the House, but in the Senate, Al Gore, the vice president at the time, had to cast the deciding vote. So if you note, in Clinton years, we only needed 51 votes. We didn't need 60. This was before the era when filibusters became de rigueur, when people said, oh yeah, you need 60 votes, without even questioning why. Remember, when the Republicans were in charge, they complained bitterly about Democratic filibusters. Do you hear anybody complaining about Republican filibusters now? Is it even mentioned? Or is it just said on our news, oh, you need 60 votes to pass a bill in the Senate? No, you don't need 60 votes to pass a bill in the Senate. That's false, or at least a gross simplification of the truth. You need 60 votes to cut off debate so that you can vote on a bill that requires 51 votes. Heck, we have Vice President Joe Biden, 50 votes in the Senate. You need 60 votes to cut off debate. And one thing that the majority leader can do is force the Republicans to actually hold a filibuster, to have a filibuster. See, filibusters used to be difficult things to do. Even in the days when Strom Thurmond was filibustering the Civil Rights Act in the late 50s and early 60s. These were great filibusters. You got to give the old racist some credit. He worked hard to try to stop equal rights for African Americans. He would talk all day long, hours and hours on end, sometimes more than 24 hours, and even have special facilities. Did you know this? Special, well, facilities is the wrong word. Let's say in those pre-C-SPAN days, containers, so that he could relieve himself during his talk. That couldn't have been pleasant for the man, but he knew that if he ever gave up and stepped down from the podium, there'd be a vote, and civil rights would be passed, and there is no one more hateful and despising of equal rights for all Americans than Strom Thurmond. This was a guy willing to work very hard to stop it. Today, filibusters are easy. Republicans say, we're going to filibuster, and Harry Reid says, okay, all right, I got to get 60 votes. That's it. And then he works around and tries to get 60 votes, and we know what happened in the stimulus package. We know because they haven't seated Al Franken yet. And that's going to happen, my friends. They're dragging it out as long as they possibly can. Remember all the Republicans that said that the presidency is too important to get it right? Seat George Bush, not Al Gore, because counting the votes just takes too much time and effort, and we don't want any more court proceedings. Well, they're taking the opposite view now in Minnesota. And while I firmly believe that every vote should be counted, you know, they really seem to be taking their time. And no one seems to be mentioning the 180-degree switch of the Republican Party as they bring up new arguments. I mean, Senator Coleman is literally arguing that the court should count ballots that Senator Coleman himself said shouldn't be counted, oh, just weeks before. Can Republicans spell hypocrisy? I'm certain they cannot. In any case, with Al Franken out of the Senate, Obama needed two Republicans. Eventually, and it may take another 3 months, he'll need one Republican, but he did need at least two to get past the 60 needed to stop the Republican filibuster. And again, I wish Harry Reid had gone about it the old-fashioned way. Make the Republicans talk all night. Frist did it. Do you remember when the majority leader, Senator Frist of Tennessee, was trying to get judges, right-wing extremist, lawless, really, judges, on the bench? And the Democrats were filibustering, and he did a whole all-night spectacle. He brought cots into the Senate. He made the Democrats talk all night long to prevent the vote. The Democrats believed in their cause, and to their credit, did talk all night. But Frist made his point as well. The majority rule was not being respected. How come the Democrats never do that spectacle? I asked someone on the Hill who spoke to me off the record. I will not give that person's name. But I do have contacts on the Hill. That's part of the reason I'm here on the air, giving you the inside scoop, right? It's because I have these contacts. And I talked with this unnamed congressional staffer who is in the know about why the Democrats don't do it. And this person said, honestly, Democrats are kind of lazy. They don't want to stay up all night. See, the way it works is once the filibusterers, in this case the Republicans, stop speaking, the filibusterees, in this case the Democrats, have to be ready for an immediate vote. See, the only two ways to end debate. One is to invoke cloture, get that magic 60 vote count. And the other way is simply the debate ends. People stop speaking. And if that happens, you have to call for a vote and then get all your members there for a vote before the opposition party gets their members there for a vote. So if someone stops speaking at 2 a.m., you have to have a Democrat ready, not just to call for a vote in the room. That's not so hard to do, to get one Democrat to sit in the chamber and read the newspaper while the Republican drones on and hope that he stops talking. But then you have to get all the Democrats there. And, well, you know, not all of them are available. They've got to go home. They've got to raise money. They've got to be in their constituents. The stunt, if you will, of requiring Republicans to do the filibuster the old-fashioned way has costs, and it's a pain, and blah, blah, blah. Well, now you know the real reason. It's not because of strategy. It's not because of politics. It's laziness. I don't expect there to be many forced Republican filibusters, but I made my opinion known to this person in the know, and hopefully that opinion will be passed on. There are ways around the filibuster, and one of the questions I plan to ask both Congressman Van Hollen and Congressman Pallone tomorrow and Thursday is why can't we get around some of them? For example, the Senate in a budget bill can't filibuster. That's just the rules. Okay. The other interesting option, and one I do not support, is one I raised with Republican Mike Lane a week ago on my show. Remember the nuclear option? You have to take the dust off of it because it hasn't been mentioned since the Republicans controlled Congress. Many people forget. The Republicans called it the constitutional option. You know, I just don't hear Senator McConnell or Senator McCain talking a lot about the constitutional option. Where's Lindsey Graham when you need him? He used to mention it all the time. The argument, the Republicans said, is that the filibuster is unconstitutional. declare it gone. And even though the Senate rules require a two-thirds number of senators to change the rules, just say those rules are unconstitutional too. Majority rules. Bye-bye to 200-plus years of filibuster. Just declare it gone. That was the Republican argument. And indeed, the threat of the nuclear option is largely what helped get people like Justice Alito on the bench, who, let's not forget, had 42 negative votes, enough to sustain filibuster. Mike Lane, to his credit, I don't know if you heard this show, admitted that in his view the nuclear option was still valid, and the Democrats could do it if they wanted to. I give him points for consistency. But note, in effect, what the Republicans are saying. When we're in charge, Republicans say, we need 50 votes. When Democrats are in charge, they need 60 votes. That's fair, right? Republicans need a majority. Democrats need 60%. Has anyone in the media brought up this hypocrisy other than yours truly? Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, anybody? It's a basic, basic hypocrisy, one so basic that it actually goes over the head of most Americans. 3 years ago, 50 was the number in the Senate. Today, 60 is the number in the Senate, and Democrats and Republicans spout that off as if it were gospel. I say, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And I think Republicans need to vote under Democratic rule about how they feel about the nuclear option. I would love to ask Lindsey Graham that kind of question. Oh, Betsy tells me that Rachel Maddow has talked about it. Good for her. Good for her. She should. She should talk about it. I plan to talk about it a lot. But I want to discuss in this hour the overall question of bipartisanship, and it seems to be a proper time now that Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire, the Republican that was going to be Obama's Commerce Secretary, has pulled out. Now, Gregg says that he's pulled out because he doesn't support the administration's agenda. Okay, fair enough. I get it. You're a Republican. Obama's a Democrat. Obama reached out. He tried to be bipartisan. You're not interested. Fine. But why do you think he accepted in the first place? Did he not know Obama's agenda? Let me suggest to you that the Republicans' new strategy is not one planned in the deep, dank corners of Karl Rove's basement on November 5th, 2008, the day after the election, but one that they're feeling as they come around, that the Republicans saw the landslide victory, and it was a landslide. No Democrat in American history since the Civil War, say, I mean, maybe Andrew Jackson did. Let's see, since Andrew Jackson. Yeah, I think we could say since Andrew Jackson. No Democrat since Andrew Jackson, with two exceptions, Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, has gotten a higher percentage of the popular vote than Barack Obama. And the numbers in Congress, one shy of a filibuster, are also very impressive. The last time the Democrats had this many was under Jimmy Carter, but that was a very, very different Democratic Party. Recall that Carter was elected with the Solid South. Alabama, Mississippi, Texas voted for Carter. Now, maybe they misunderstood Jimmy Carter, but the members of Congress at that time, and even under Bill Clinton, included such luminaries as Sam Nunn of Georgia, a man so afraid that another man was going to see his private parts in the shower that he decided to fire thousands of innocent gay men and women from the military and ruin the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on their training just so no one would see Nun's Willie. I guess he doesn't like it very much. That was a very conservative Democratic Party under Carter, under Clinton. Today it's very different. I would dare say, of the 59 Democrats, including our two independents, Bernie Sanders and Joe Lieberman, a good 57 are progressive. I'll leave out Lieberman and Ben Nelson of Nebraska. And you know what? On domestic issues, Lieberman's fairly progressive. We might even get to 58. This is the most progressive Congress, I would dare say, since Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt. And the Republicans need to recognize that. Alan, the trucker, is calling from on the road. Alan, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hello, Mark.
Hello, welcome.
I was going to ask you about the stimulus bill and the tax cuts in it.
Sure.
Did they get a special deal for millionaires in the stimulus bill for taxes?
Well, kind of. What happened is this: the House didn't include it, and then the Senate voted to include basically an alternative minimum tax fix. Now, what does that mean? About 20 years ago, maybe even longer, the Congress recognized that a lot of millionaires, a lot of very rich people, weren't paying as much of their income in taxes as middle-class people. As Warren Beatty, I believe it was Warren Beatty, Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett, who talked about the fact that he was paying less in taxes than his secretary. So they created something called an alternative minimum tax. And that means if you make 200 grand or so, and you're not paying the percentage that a middle-class person makes because you're paying, say, a lot of capital gains or other things that are taxed less than what middle-class people are taxed on their income tax. This alternative minimum tax made sure that you still paid, if not your fair share, at least more than you should. So this is a tax that has always rankled people of wealth, and as it was an index for inflation, increasingly people in the upper middle class. It doesn't just apply to millionaires. It applies to about quarter millionaires or so, still quite rich people. Well, the Republicans have been fixing, quote unquote, the alternative minimum tax really every year for the last 3, 4, 5 years. And it needed to be fixed this year. Fixed, by the way, means ignored, ended, not affecting as many people. It's a tax cut. It's a tax cut for rich people and, upper middle class people. I consider you rich if you make more than $150,000 a year. People may disagree. In any case, the House didn't include it. The Senate put it in. Indeed, Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, who did not vote for the stimulus package, stuck it in. And it's a good $70 billion. And one of the things that the Democrats had argued when the Republicans were in power is if you want to have this tax cut, you got to pay for it. See, the Democrats were the fiscal conservatives. They wanted to pay as you go. The Republicans wanted huge deficit spending. You may recall until, the last couple weeks when they've turned on the dime and now hate deficit spending. So they had a hard time getting it through. Anyway, the Senate passed it, and apparently it was one of the requirements for the three Republicans, Arlen Specter and Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, to sign on board. So what they did is they took that money out of money that was going to the states, which is really important, recession-proof funds, money that was going to build schools and for other education projects, and instead put it in this tax cut. And the other thing about the tax cut for the super rich is it does very, very little to stimulate the economy, because you give a tax cut to people who are poor and middle class, they need to spend it. They have rent payments. They've got to go to the grocery. Rich people are already spending that money, and they're likely to put it in the bank. So basically, there is that portion of it. It's not something I approve of, but to be fair, it does represent less than 10% of the bill, and I think it's fair to say that overall, the bill was a good bill. Did that answer your question, Alan?
Yeah, it sounded like they took money from some programs that was good, like building schools, to go for tax cuts for millionaires, and they did that to appease the Republicans. And then the Republicans never did even vote on it.
That's true. Charles Grassley, who put in the alternative minimum tax fix, then voted against it. It did, though, Alan, appease the few Republicans who did vote for it. Because the Republicans in the Senate were filibustering the bill, and because Franken has yet to be seated, Obama needed two Republican votes. He got three, and Specter, Snow, and Collins did insist on this portion of the bill. So I don't think – and this is one of the questions I'm going to ask my two members of Congress guests tomorrow and Thursday. But my understanding is that they couldn't have gotten the stimulus approved without this fix, that it was a quid pro quo and that it was a requirement in order to get the three Republicans necessary to get past the filibuster.
Yeah, and I heard you say something about a majority. It must be 60%.
Well, no,
50%.
Well, that's my point. A majority is 50%, and indeed, to pass a bill in the Senate requires only 50 votes now that we have a vice president that's on our side. If there's 50-50, he can cast the deciding vote. So it only requires 50 votes, but there is this filibuster. And Republicans said they were going to filibuster the bill, and so to cut off debate to ever get to a vote, you need 60. And my point I was making at the beginning of the broadcast was that the Republicans have made the 60-vote requirement de rigueur, just something that's ordinary, just, oh, you need 60 votes, without even questioning it. In other words, they've gone on automatic filibuster. Filibusters used to be rare and unusual and dramatic events. That's the example I gave of Strom Thurmond in the Civil Rights Act. It was an awful thing that he did, but at least he had to suffer a lot physically in order to do it. They, you know, people had to talk all night long. Today, the Republicans just say, they make a big capital F. We're filibustering everything. And so the Harry Reid just says, okay, we need 60, and he goes on with his day.
Well, I feel like it'll be good if they do filibuster this thing. It'll bring about debates that we need on this issue, on the issue of taxes.
Well, they did filibuster it. They did, and in order to get past the 60, we needed two Republicans. Three jumped on board. The two relatively moderate senators from Maine and Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania. But I guess what I'm saying is that today a filibuster is no longer capital F. It's just it's a rubber stamp. Mitch McConnell has told Harry Reid, we're filibustering everything for the next 2 years. Just it's not an unusual event. It's literally what we're doing on every single bill. So you always need 60, just so you know. And Harry Reid has said, okay, and then he seeks around and he tries to get 60 without in any way attacking, insulting, or excoriating the Republicans for filibustering everything, as the Republicans did to the Democrats when they did an occasional filibuster and the Republicans were in the majority. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I hear that Harry Reid's not – I keep getting the impression that Harry Reid's just not fighting hard enough. Maybe I'm getting the
I'll tell you this. Harry Reid is better behind closed doors than he is in open doors. I don't find him to be that persuasive an orator or that he's not that great on talk shows. He's not someone who does some of the political stunts that Republicans pulled, like Frist pulled and so forth. I will give Harry Reid a little bit of credit, though. Behind closed doors, he is pretty good at rounding up votes. I mean, even though I don't like the changes the Republicans made to the stimulus package, namely the alternative minimum tax fix, taking money away from schools and from states and local governments who need it, I have to say that overall it's still pretty good. I mean, it's 90% of what we wanted. And Harry Reid did get the votes, and he got Ben Nelson's vote of Nebraska. This is a Democrat who comes from a very red state, who is not at all certain to necessarily support a progressive agenda. Lieberman came in line. We had to leave him as the head of the Homeland Security Committee. But honestly, I think that was the right political decision to make. Better to have Lieberman on our side than against us. We need his vote. And so Harry Reid is very good at counting votes and getting the amount of votes needed. And so I want to make clear that while I disagree with portions of the bill and while I'm upset the Republicans did what they did, I still think, overall, it's a very good bill. In fact, I don't think it goes far enough. But this is still a huge, dramatic influx of funds for all kinds of good things. Everything from, you know, schools to green energy to high-speed rail to infrastructure building to aid to people who are who need health care, who are, you know, struggling with unemployment payments. It does give a tax cut to middle-class people. It's mostly a very good bill, and so I don't want to overemphasize the portions with which I disagree.
Okay, that's a pretty good answer you gave me. I'm usually out on the road, so tonight I'm going to go to a Democratic meeting, so thought I'd tell you that. Give a plug in for an organization called Over the Mountain Democrats in Birmingham, Alabama area.
All right. And listen, Alabama's one of the reddest states in America. Alan, if you can do your part to make it just a little bit purple, you'll have gone a long way. Thanks very much for your call. I appreciate
it. Okay, thank you. All right.
We got another Southerner on the line, Steve from Atlanta. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark, it's great to talk to you. I don't think I've talked to you for years since you used to be on around noon.
Yeah, it was about a couple years since I've heard from you. How are you?
I'm doing great. finally got a chance to get home a little early, so now I can hear your show. I usually hear it on podcast, and I still enjoy it.
Well, I appreciate that you've listened all these years and that you're calling in. What are your thoughts on the end of bipartisanship? Obama reached out to Republicans and kind of got his hand slapped.
Mark, you are A1 on the money as far as the Democrats are just, they're wusses, if I can say that on air. They're absolutely.
You can say it on air.
And, I mean, there is no leadership. You know, you may not want to criticize Reid too much, but I will. I mean,
well, I partially criticized him. I give him some criticism. I just don't think he's the devil incarnate. I mean, I try to be fair to the man. I do think he's good in private, behind closed doors, at getting the votes that are necessary. I think he's
perhaps
a terrible public.
There comes a time when you have to do a little bit of theater. You need a little bit of political theater, and he's got to start doing that. He's got to, because I want these issues to be on the table. I want them to be out in public. And if he were to filibuster, then we'd have these issues out in public. You know, why are we cutting some of these things for education? Why are we cutting some of these Planned Parenthood type programs? You know, that kind of deal. And
you're right. He's terrible at theater. And in fact, Nancy Pelosi is better at it than he is. She ain't great, but even she at least can do a bit of theater from time to time. Part of it maybe is personality. He's just kind of bland. But you're absolutely right. I believe theater is necessary. Listen, one of the things President Obama does so well is theater. He inspires people. And I don't mean to, you know, theater makes it sound like it's not important. It is important. It's a bully pulpit, as Theodore Roosevelt used to say. And the drama, the personality, the charisma matters. Absolutely.
Yes. Say, you know, your ideas have failed. They've absolutely failed us for the last 8 years, maybe 20 or 30 years.
Right. And Obama is saying that, to Obama's credit. Yeah. Reid isn't so much. But Obama, I mean, I actually think Obama's press conference was masterful. I mean, he really laid it on the line. And the best part about it is I think a spurned suitor looks better than had he just ignored the Republicans from the beginning. I think the American people get it. 67% approve of Obama today, 25% disapprove. I think Americans see that Obama did reach out to the Republicans and was burned. And Republicans are saying, you know, well, he didn't even reach out. Americans aren't buying that line. They know the Republicans are merely the party of no. And so I think it was a good idea that he reached out to them. You know, maybe he gave a bit too much on the front end with starting with one-third tax cuts. Maybe he should have started lower in the bargaining process. But I actually think that in terms of theater, it looked good for him to reach out to Republicans, even though he was spurned.
And now what they can say, they being Democrats or whatever Democrat candidates are running against Republicans, now they can say, look, we gave you a bill with your tax cuts, and you voted against it.
Right.
You know? Let me ask you a question about the stimulus package.
Okay.
My two things about it are, obviously, in order to help cure this recession, we need jobs. And at the same time, we have to whittle away at this deficit, if that can be done. So, you know, I know he's got a lot in there about green jobs and stuff. I'd like to see some more just basic manufacturing of basic goods done in America. And do you see anything coming down that road? And also, as far as the deficit, is he eventually going to start taxing the rich?
Okay, two very separate questions. Let me start with your first one. Manufacturing, you have to understand, and I think you do, Steve, that there's a glut. There's a surplus in our economy of goods. Basically, manufacturers did what they normally do. They made the normal amount of goods for any given years, and then demand dropped off dramatically. When the stock market collapsed and a lot of people lost their savings and 401ks and a lot of people lost their homes and lost their jobs, obviously people are more concerned. They didn't spend as much in the holiday season as they used to, and people are holding back. So you have manufacturers who've made cars is the best example, but the same could be said for furniture or really any other large purchase, or even, toys. I mean, just any old item. They made them, and they weren't bought, and so they're sitting in warehouses, and that's one reason why the manufacturers are now cutting jobs, because they have too little demand. One of the things that surplus...
I see your point, but I'm talking specifically about American manufacturing.
No, I understand. You have a point, too, Steve, that a lot of these things are made in China these days. But my point is that because demand, and it's worldwide demand, not just American demand, it's a worldwide depression. Because demand has dropped off so much, they have these goods that aren't being sold, and so they don't produce anymore because they're waiting for those goods to be sold. And it's a vicious cycle because then they lay off people, and then those people buy less, and then more goods are in surplus, and you have a downward spiral. That's what causes a recession, causes a depression. So the purpose of the stimulus package is to get us out of that through government spending. And the government spending is not going to be 99% of the time on consumer goods, on things like cars and furniture and toys and the kinds of things that will help the economy, the manufacturing kind of jobs you're talking about, because those aren't things governments buy. But governments do buy new things like new roads, or rebuilding, or high-speed rail, or green jobs, new jobs in energy. And by creating these new jobs, new people get money, or even, you know, old construction workers get money. Then they go and buy the cars and the toys and the furniture, and then manufacturers, rejuvenate themselves. But that's why it all takes time. That's why it's not going to happen tomorrow. It probably won't happen by the end of 2009. My hope is it'll happen by, say, spring of 2010, because government can't really, at least unless you have an idea, Steve, which I'd be anxious to hear. I don't think government can create manufacturing jobs very easy.
I don't think they can. My point was the only way they could help do that would be through increasing tariffs.
Which I don't think is a good idea.
Really?
You may agree with me. Yeah, I don't. I've studied the Great Depression. I remember the infamous Smoot-Hawley tariff bill in the late 1920s. We have a worldwide recession. And while I desperately want to protect American jobs, I think if we raise tariffs, it just leads to everyone raising tariffs, Europeans and Chinese and India, everyone raising tariffs, and soon everyone is worse off. I mean, it's not like you just raise tariffs, sometimes people look at protectionist ideas and they say, oh, we raise tariffs in America, and that protects American jobs. What they're not looking at is the response of other countries who can also raise their tariffs. And if everyone raises their tariffs, everyone is worse off. So I don't see that as the way to go. Go ahead.
One of the things that seems that, in my opinion, has led to the recession has been the lack of good-paying jobs. You know, there has been really no wealth created in the United States. It's all been this finance stuff, which is basically pushing money around. We're not creating any wealth. And so, you know, which leads to things like this mortgage crisis, I guess, and I'm sorry, I'm a little scatterbrained. I usually write my thoughts down, but
No, that's okay. I mean, I think you're right that there are not many good-paying jobs, largely because, I mean, George Bush basically took money from the poor and gave it to the rich. His tax policies meant that, if you were struggling to get along at a decent job, you paid more, and the person who was creating the non-existent wealth got hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. So you're right, that's certainly true in the past, but it wasn't the lack – but you're also right that it wasn't the lack of good jobs that caused the specific depression. It was the financial crisis. It was the pushing around the wealth that didn't matter, and these credit derivative swaps and this sort of fake Ponzi scheme much larger than anything Bernie Madoff created in the whole economy. So I think that in terms of basic manufacturing jobs, America has lost over the last 20, 30 years manufacturing jobs. And I think part of that is natural. It's not we are doing more service jobs, more IT work and less making cars. We got more robots to create cars. I think that's actually somewhat natural and somewhat something that really you can't stop. It's almost to me like the blacksmith doesn't make horseshoes anymore because we don't have horses so much.
Right,
we have more cars.
In this country of ours, not everybody can work in the service industry. You've got people.
Well, there's a big service industry
out there.
Factory
making something.
No, but Steve, there's a bunch of services out there. I mean, McDonald's is service industry, right? You know, massage is service industry. There are services for unskilled workers. I mean, look, I don't want to destroy America's manufacturing base. I'm not arguing for that. But I do think that we have to open our eyes and recognize that there is a natural decline in it. And I don't think that we can artificially prop it up. What we can do, though, is encourage it to go into the new sectors. For example, more green cars. Now, that is a new job. That is a 21st century job rather than a 20th century technology. A green car, a fuel cell car, an electric car, is to a gasoline-powered car the way a gasoline-powered car was to the old horses. I don't cry over the lost blacksmith's jobs. I recognize that in the 1920s we needed cars. And what I'm saying is today new manufacturing jobs, not old ones, are the ones we need to create. And that's what the surplus bill is doing. Green jobs is a big part of this surplus bill.
Okay. Well,
I mean,
I have to disagree with you on this one. I think
okay.
that there is some just a national security where we want to at least have some factories around, and perhaps we do. Maybe we do.
Well, I'm not saying we want no factories. Please don't misunderstand me, Steve. I'm just saying that sometimes old technology gives way to new, and old factories gives way to new factories. I'm not saying we're going to end all manufacturing in America.
Sure, but we're not manufacturing any electronics. We're not manufacturing any furniture. We're not manufacturing
well, yeah, we are.
Any. Not much. You go
oh, come on. North Carolina, I know, is one of the centers of furniture in the world.
Sure. They were.
You don't think they are anymore?
I don't think they are. I think there's been a lot of things.
Carolina?
I could be wrong. Maybe some of your listeners from North Carolina will call in.
Look, you're right that China is underselling us on a lot of these things. You're absolutely right about that. And
let's get on with the second part of the question.
All right, okay, fair enough. Let's go on with the deficit. Okay, all right. The deficit, I think, and I've made this argument before on my show, is something to be worried about in good times, but not something to be worried about in bad times. If you have good times, you should watch and make sure you don't overeat and become fat and get a heart attack. But if you're starving, you need food, even if you have to borrow, beg, or steal.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, you've heard my show for – I've been on the air 5.5 years, and I think it's fair to say for the first 4.5 years, I was a deficit hawk. We were doing okay. It wasn't a great economy, but we were expanding. And from 2003 to really the beginning of last year, I argued we have to be careful, pay as you go. I'm a fiscal conservative in good or even fair times.
Mm-hmm.
But in bad times, I recognize that this is a point not to be concerned about the deficit. Call me in 2011, and I promise to be concerned about the deficit again. But it's
right.
a real mistake, in my view, to be concerned about the deficit when we're facing the greatest depression since the Great Depression.
But are there – I mean, he didn't roll back any tax cuts on the rich. Am I correct?
Not yet, but he will.
Okay. You think
they expire
okay,
in 2010.
That's a good point.
Well, no, but they expire okay. in 2010, and I think that actually – I understand Obama's reasoning that when he made that promise 2 years ago, we didn't have the depression that we're in now. What he's saying is, I will let them expire, the Bush tax cuts. They naturally expire in 2010. 2010 should be about the time the economy picks up again, so that's a natural time to let them expire.
Mm-hmm.
If the economy picks up sooner, then, he could knock them out sooner. But that one doesn't particularly bother me, even though I don't support those tax cuts. Again, it's sort of I the way I see it, we're sort of in emergency hunker down, cure the economy, status, which I consider
an
acceptable
status. But I don't think that taxing the rich another percent or two right now is going to slow any recession recovery down at all. You know, that's
well, you may be right. I mean, certainly we didn't need another tax cut with the alternative minimum tax cut. But you know, part of it also, Steve, is political capital. Mm-hmm. Obama has a very big agenda. He's got to get us closer to universal health care. He's got to promote more green energy. He's got to help us in education and get that money back in that Republicans took out. He's got to give D.C. the right to vote. He's got to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell for gay people. He's got a fairly large agenda. And I think that since these tax cuts expire anyway in 2010, which is just next year, I think he's decided that
just
in
hold
addition
off on that
to, yeah, you know, you got to pick your battles. And, right. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not the biggest and most important battle to pick. And I guess I agree with him on that.
Well, very good answers. Hey, I was reading this blog one time. This guy posted this recent congressional budget report that said that we should be getting out of the recession here soon anyway. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. But let me tell you why Republicans are saying things like that. Republicans are trying to be on. Well, I don't know who your blogger is because I didn't read your blog, but I know that Paul Robeson.
No, the report was from the report was from the CBO, Congressional Budget Office.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'll post it on your blog.
I got to give credit to the CBO. They are generally a neutral source. But
sure.
Here, let me Karl Rove is arguing that we're going to get out of the recession soon. And I think Republicans are desperately trying to be on both sides of the argument. If this recession lasts longer than people expect into 2010, 2011, they're going to say, we didn't vote for the stimulus package. It was a bad idea. It didn't help the economy. Vote for us. Democrats are bad stewards of the economy. If we come out sooner, then they're going to point to things like the CBO. They're going to point to Karl Rove, and they're going to say, see, we told you we'd come out. We didn't need the stimulus package anyway. You see, that way they can have it on both sides. And I guarantee you my Republican friend Mike Lane will argue if we come out early, it was going to happen anyway. And if we come out late, he's going to say, see, the stimulus package didn't help at all.
I'm
a little wary of
the memo already.
What's that?
I was saying, I'm sure he's gotten that talking points memo already.
Well, that's exactly right. And so you have to
be a little careful.
I'll
let you go.
Okay. And, Steve, I appreciate you calling in. It's been a couple years, but I hope you'll call in more frequently. And I appreciate your call. Let me say this about bipartisanship. I do think it was worth the try. I know there are some on the liberal end, progressive end, that are saying Obama gave away too much to the Republicans. But I think sometimes trying and failing is better than never trying at all. I mean, I would agree, if you look at it objectively, that, well, he started with a third tax cuts, and he ended up with 40% or so tax cuts, and, you know, maybe he should have started at 20 and ended up at a third. That's sort of how you bargain. But that's, I guess, a minor point in my view. The heart of it is the drama, is the theater, is the perception, and the perception of Obama walking hat in hand to the Republicans. For the Republicans, they took it as a win. They were jeering, ha ha, new president coming on hands and knees, and we're going to stomp on your hands. But that wasn't the way the American people saw it. I think the American people saw the new president very strong, coming out of a strong election, reaching out in strength to the Republicans and saying, do you want to help the American economy? And the Republicans said no, or as Rush Limbaugh so pithily put it, I hope he fails. We want you to fail, Obama. We want America to fail. We want the economy to worsen. We want the depression to be much, 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 much worse, and then we can get more power in the next election. I think Americans understand that Republicans put their party ahead of their country, that they wanted America to fail. You know, I remember at the time of the Iraq War, Republicans arguing, you Democrats want us to fail in Iraq. You want us not to succeed. Because then your view, that we should have never gone into Iraq in the first place, seems more right, and then more Americans vote for you. And I remember saying to those Republicans, I don't want us to fail. I want us to succeed, but that doesn't change my view that we never should have been in Iraq in the first place. It was, as President Obama has said, the wrong war at the wrong time. Never should have been authorized, never should have been fought. Iraq didn't attack us. And even though Dick Cheney lied to a whole bunch of people and said they did, they didn't. And Democrats knew that. So, of course, we want our troops to succeed, but it was the wrong policy. Republicans, though, generally don't want us to succeed. And how do you know this? You know this because they haven't put forward an alternative policy. The alternative policy the Republicans put forward was almost a joke. And indeed, very few Americans even know it was put forward. It was $3 trillion solely in tax cuts over the next 10 years. It was more than four times, well, about the same as four times, the entire Obama stimulus package. If you take out the tax cuts in the Obama package, it was six times the government spending in the stimulus package. That's it. That was their whole great idea. It was a non-starter. It was not put forward for negotiation. It was not a good faith attempt to work with the new president. It was a laughable non-starter. It was a I hope you fail package. We did not come to play ball. Go away, Mr. President. We're going to take you down. And it's amazing to me. Well, I guess I shouldn't say it's amazing. It's actually, I guess, quite typical. But it should be amazing to some who argued, you know, the Democrats aren't even giving Bush a chance. And if you recall, the Democrats gave Bush every chance. Does anyone remember September 11th, 2001? Does anyone remember Democrats and Republicans joining hand in hand and singing God Bless America on that awful day? Democrats and Republicans working together, and I was one of them, to create the original version of the Patriot Act that allowed for protection of civil liberties at the same time as it gave the government better tools to fight terrorists. Does anyone remember what George Bush did at that time? He took our truly bipartisan bills, and I mean bills that everybody voted for, from the farthest left to the farthest right. He took our efforts to work very hard for 3 weeks to craft, really, I have to say, an amazing compromise, protecting civil liberties, protecting our Bill of Rights, and going after terrorists. And he threw the bill in the trash and then gave Congress 1 hour to vote on what became the Patriot Act. I was there when that happened. I saw it. The Democrats were reaching out to Bush. He was slapping their hand. He argued that with all the massive surpluses of the Clinton years, none of it should be put aside for a rainy day. None of it should be put aside to shore up Social Security and Medicare. All of it should be used as a tax cut for the rich. No compromises there. This is a president, George Bush, who purposely ruled out. Karl Rove admitted it. He won 51% of the vote. Obama has gone on the other side. Obama has reached out to Republicans. Obama is the one spurned. It seems it's always Democrats, whether we're the majority or the minority, that reach out to Republicans and get our hands slapped. Okay. That's okay. That's okay. And you know what? I'm glad we do. Because elections are not won by the left or the right. Peace, Karl Rove. They're won by the middle. They're won by the center. They're won by the independents who actually do care about bipartisanship and don't want to see needless fighting. And the independents see very clearly that the Democrats reached out and Republicans burned us. Okay, we tried. And we didn't fail. They did. So now, will Obama reach out the next time? Probably a little bit less. Maybe he'll start the bargaining at a different number, at a more Democratic, less Republican number. Rahm Emanuel says he'll make sure that Republicans agree to pass the bill if they get what they want in the bill. That's a good one. In fact, the Senate, I remember, voted for a huge tax cut if you flip your house to somebody new. But no Republicans promised to vote for the stimulus package, so the conference committee took that right out of the bill. Good for them. Obama reached out to Senator Gregg of New Hampshire, inviting Republicans in his administration, giving them a say, but not the say. And Gregg said, no. No, I don't want a say. I want the say. I don't care that the American people voted for the Democrats. I want to be in charge. So Obama and Gregg went their respective ways. And that's okay. That's okay. Because that shows the center, hey, we tried. We tried. It would be the same as true as if Obama works to get rid of Iran's nuclear weapons through diplomacy. And then Iran just says, nah, no deal. Okay, we tried. But if we try, and if we're spurned, then we can move forward. It takes a little bit of extra time to try diplomacy first. But it shows the world that the other side is not serious. You know, I think about when Israel offered at the Camp David Accords to Yasser Arafat to have a complete Palestinian state, 95%, 97% of the land. Everything he says he always wanted, and Arafat said no. And that exposed Arafat as a fraud. He wasn't interested in a Palestinian state. He simply wanted to be the naysayer. By reaching out to Republicans, Obama is showing the world the Republican Party for what they are. They are the party of no. And so let him pick off Susan Collins and Olympia Snow and Arlen Specter from blue, blue, blue states. That's fine. He can keep doing it. And he can do it with universal health care. And he can do it with children's health care. And he can do it with education. And he can do it with green energy. And he can do it with the D.C. vote. He can do it with don't ask, don't tell, getting rid of that policy. That's just fine. Because the American people are getting it. And the Republicans who are cheering now and breaking glass and bringing out their glasses of champagne and saying, none of us voted for this awful stimulus bill, celebrating no, are against the very zeitgeist of America, the aura of where we are. They are spitting on the millions of Americans that attended the Obama inauguration and the hundreds of millions that gave him the greatest electoral victory we've seen in some time. They're saying to not Obama, but they're saying to America, we don't want you to succeed. We have no, we do not want the president to succeed. We don't want to join with the Democrats to find a solution. We are the party of no. We are the party of Rush Limbaugh. We are the party of I hope he fails. I hope America fails. It's not going to work for them. So I say to President Obama, I say to the Democrats, keep reaching out to the Republicans. Keep reaching out. Just don't expect them to take your hand. And when they don't, no one in America can blame you if you go forward and vote for and prepare the progressive ideals that you were elected to serve the American people. Hope you enjoyed the show today. Tomorrow, a very special guest, Congressman Chris Van Hollen, is going to talk about the stimulus package. And then, really exciting, next Tuesday, veteran reporter Helen Thomas, who's been reporting on the White House since John F. Kennedy. I have a full hour with her on the Inside Scoop. You won't want to miss that. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.